You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Paul.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Cannot complain. Let me introduce this, Paul. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter. This is the Non-Zero podcast, and also kind of a collaboration with the newsletter you published, a falsely modest Small Potatoes newsletter. You're also known as a famous psychologist and author. What am I leaving out, Paul?
That's it. That's more than Bennett.
More than you deserve?
More than I deserve. I'm feeling very humble this morning. I may be unusually deferential. I had a period in our discussions where I was asserting myself, but I think I'm going to pull back.
When was that? That was like a month ago or so?
That was like a month ago. For a friend of mine said, you know, you're treating this like you're a guest, but no, treat it as a collaborative effort. You know, make a point, direct the conversation yourself. And I did it successfully for a whole session. But then it's just easier to be like a guest in your house.
Yeah. Plus, you shouldn't get uppity. On this podcast. In fact, I advise all guests not to get uppity. A lot to talk.
A lot to talk about.
Excuse me. First of all, we won't talk about this first, but the famous philosopher Daniel Dennett has passed away. I can't think of any two people better positioned to assess his legacy and so on than Daniel Dennett, than us. He actually would have been better qualified than us, possibly.
And a few weeks ago, we were talking about the death of another great Daniel Kahneman.
And yeah, So it's true that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, I guess, kind of.
We should talk about it. Dennett was maybe the most... had a claim to be the most important living philosopher, and now we lost him.
And in addition, there was a certain amount of tension between me and him, which I can get into.
I have heard. Yes,
I will say that as a disclaimer. But first, the other thing, also we can talk about the three body problem eventually, maybe, because I think we both now finished it. This is the TV series. But also our nation's campuses are said to be in turmoil. Maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but there are protests that have been spreading and counter protests having to do with Gaza. These are issues of free speech.
There's been media attention directed towards Harvard and Yale and Columbia. I was waiting for the media to direct its focus to what's happening in Ivy League universities. And finally they did it.
Finally it's happened. Finally, we have some Ivy League presidents under pressure from Congress.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, only two have been fired as a result of that. And there are, after all, eight, I think, Ivy League schools. And you were, until recently, a professor at one of them, Yale.
Yes.
Where some of this action happened. And you're still an emeritus at Yale.
Yeah.
I think your hair should get a little grayer before you really embrace that title full on. But
I'm gonna go there in a couple of weeks because I have a brilliant student, Gracie Reneke, is defending her dissertation. So I'm coming back to be there in person.
So you'll be involved in that process? You'll give thumbs up or thumbs down?
The hard part is over. I would give a thumbs up, but I will introduce her for her presentation, which is on how children, among other things, how children and adults deal with AI, with robots. And it's really great work.
Yeah, I'd be interested in that. Seriously, I'm writing a book on AI, as you may know.
I do know.
You should send me a PDF.
I will do exactly that. It's a well-written and very interesting dissertation.
So, as for this campus turmoil thing, I don't know exactly where to begin. I guess people know. It started at Columbia.
Yeah.
With a kind of student, kind of like what was called during the Vietnam War, a student sit-in, I guess. Although those often happened inside buildings. This is an encampment occupying one of the Columbia campus. For people who haven't been there, it's an urban campus, not a ton of open space, but in the middle of it there are kind of three rectangles of openness, and at least a couple of them have grass on them, I think. And anyway, one of those three is occupied by these students. There are tents and so on. They are, of course, pro-Palestine, And I don't know, maybe you can take it from there. What has most caught your attention about this whole controversy?
I've been following it with interest, and there's also been some similar things at Yale, a bit of a smaller scale, near the Beinecke, this beautiful building, but library and everything, with students occupying that area. I've been following from a lot of people who have been complaining about anti-Semitic incidents, violence towards Jewish students, harassment of Jewish students. I think some of these claims have been really overblown, because I think some have happened. I've been looking at the debate between people who are saying these things should be shut down by the universities versus those who see it as a horrific infringement on the students' rights and on what they see as a good cause. I guess my main view is kind of predictable, since I'm not a free speech absolutist. There isn't such a thing, but I'm kind of into free speech, and I think that that there should be as much. Universities have a right to sort of impose manner restrictions on things. You can't protest in the middle of an intersection. You can't make loud noises 2 a.m. when people are trying to sleep in the dormitories. But they can't, and they shouldn't suppress speech. And there's many people calling for them to suppress speech. There's one guy, I don't want to talk about him in particular, but there's one guy on Twitter who I know, a prominent social psychologist, who's said many times professors who express what he says is pro-Hamas views should be punished, and students should be punished for your views. And I'm very, very, very much against that. I don't agree with a lot of the views being espoused, but I'm very much against that. That's where I start from. I start from a basic sympathy towards the right to protest, and even the right to say things that I disagree with, or in some cases I see as despicable.
Yeah, and there is a case at Columbia that speaks directly to this. I mean, this is a big part of the issue. The president of Columbia is under pressure from both sides. I mean, she started out being under pressure from Congress, I guess particularly Stefanik, who was kind of the lead interrogator of the two presidents who are no longer with us as presidents, yeah. As a result of her interrogation. That would be at Penn and at Harvard. First of all, her name is Shafiq. Do you know what her, I mean, she was born in Egypt. Do we know what, beyond that, her ethnicity is? Is she like Christian or Muslim or conceivably Jewish? There are Arab Jews, but do we? I don't
feel
know.
If she was Jewish, people would be talking about that.
Probably.
So it's just sort of a pragmatic implicature that she's not. But no, I don't know.
I mean, apparently her family left Egypt because they weren't exactly on good terms with the government. I think maybe that's because in some kind of populist reform, some of their assets were taken. I don't know exactly. Anyway, okay. So she's under pressure.
Yeah.
She went to Congress pretty recently. This is like round two. And there's a professor at Columbia that named Joseph Massad.
Yeah.
And he, and before Congress, so it was Elise Stefanik interrogating her. And he had written something controversial for the Electronic Intifada, which is an extremely edgy, I would say, pro-Palestine outlet. Stefanik asked, like, well, what, how's the university dealing with this thing he had written? And I'll get to what he had written. And Shafiq responded, he was spoken to by his head of department and his dean. And Stefanik says, and what was he told? And Shafiq, the president of Columbia, says that language was unacceptable. So I actually went and looked at this, and it's an interesting, this thing Massad wrote. He wrote it on the 8th, well, it was published on the 8th of October. He might have written it on the 7th as the thing was happening. I don't know. But what it is this, you know, he could argue that it's just repertorial, but it's very clear. It's on the other, it's extremely clear where his sympathies lie. Yeah. So it starts with, what can motorized paragliders do in the face of one of the most formidable militaries in the world? Apparently much in the hands of an innovative Palestinian resistance, which early on Saturday morning launched a surprise attack on Israel by air, land, and sea. Indeed, a stunning video show these paragliders have become the air force of the Palestinian resistance.
Sounds kind of like a wire cutter review of paragliders. Look at how efficient they are, how light and powerful.
It actually reminded me of a certain kind of story that you see these days, even in the New York Times, where it's like ostensibly repertorial, but there's like no doubt. Like the subtext makes it completely clear whose side this person is on. The other, let's see, parts of it that got him into trouble. Well, here a little more. Perhaps a major achievement of the resistance in the temporary takeover of these settler colonies is the death blow to any confidence that Israeli colonists had in their military and its ability to protect them. He got into trouble specifically for that. And also, there was a part where he said, oh, no less awesome were the scenes witnessed by millions of jubilant Arabs who spent the day watching the news of Palestinian fighters from Gaza breaking through Israel's prison fence or gliding over by air. This was also brought up in the New York Times story. Now, he did say, he certainly didn't do the, but I condemn attacks on civilians. He did, after listing Palestinian casualties, say, meanwhile, and again, he's writing on October 7th or 8th. Yeah. He says, meanwhile, the Palestinian operation has resulted in more than 700 people killed in Israel and more than 2,200 injured. All in all, a horrifying human toll on all sides. So, you know, anyway, I mean, what I would say is, for starters, he didn't say this in the class. Okay.
Yeah.
This is, whatever you think of it, it's also not part of his academic work in any meaningful. This is a journalistic outlet that he wrote this thing for. So I don't know. It's probably already clear where I stand on his department head saying this is unacceptable. I don't think that's acceptable for department heads to speak that way, but you tell me where you stand on this.
I'm sure we'll find stuff to disagree about, but this isn't one of them. I mean, I find that kind of view deeply repellent after this massive, it is a horrible view. It's none of the department's business.
You mean his view, the view he expressed.
Yeah, not yours, right. His view. His view he expressed is awful. It's like, you know, it's this horrific, we don't need to go over it. But it's an awful, amoralistic, perhaps truly evil view. None of the department heads' business, none of the dean's business. Professors, and actually people in general, but professors have a special freedom to express all sorts of views, including views people find repellent. And that should have been her answer to Stefanik. Obviously, it doesn't play well saying, it's professors have the right to say all sorts of things, many which you will disagree with. We are not in the business of censoring them or punishing them in either way. Now, to say this, as many people, which I think is exactly the right response, it would plainly be hypocritical, because if he said something like trans women are not women, or in a meritocracy, blacks would not have a good role in society, or anything about blacks, or anything about women, trans people, he would be sanctioned, punished, and his job would be in jeopardy. So there's a hypocrisy here. But nonetheless, it's still the right thing for him to say. He has freedom of speech. He has academic freedom. None of our business. If he said it in a classroom, it gets more complicated.
Yeah. So to your mind, he could have gone actually a lot further than this. I mean, you said this was like borderline evil, but he didn't say, you know, he didn't say like killing. He didn't. Well, you could argue about what he's doing. He's countenancing violence, you might say, but not advocating it, I guess. But yeah. You can imagine
In my view, and I know it's extreme, if he said we should drive the Jews into the sea, that's not very nice, but I don't think he should be sanctioned. I think that if he acted in a way towards individual students or individual people, he could be breaking laws, he could be guilty of all sorts of academic violations. But as a general claim, similarly, if somebody on the other side says we should drive the Gazans into the sea, we should kill them all, it's not a nice view, but I think it falls under the scope of academic freedom.
See, I'd be more inclined than you would be to understand the administration at that point.
Yeah.
Putting pressure on him, maybe even taking. I mean, those. I because I think you're almost getting the point there where you're actually, depending on how exactly it's framed, committing a crime, I think. I mean, advocating violence against someone in this, in when I was at a newspaper, this in the, maybe it was a state law, but making terrorist threats was a crime. Saying you're going to do violence to a particular person certainly was a crime. So I don't know. It sounds like you're more liberal in the classical sense on this than I am.
So if somebody says I advocate, suppose, you know, a hawkish Israeli says, I advocate we go into Gaza even stronger. And if we have to kill tens of thousands of people, even innocent people, to achieve our ends, so be it. Is that... That doesn't deport at all on the crime. People who argue for the invasion of Iraq.
I wouldn't say that crosses the line I was talking about. Because that, I mean, most people in the world say collateral damage is sometimes worth it, which is what that boils down to. Technically, it's what it boils down to, regardless of what actually motivates
it.
So anyway, there's that. Then there's also the issue of the protesters. I mean, is there some devil's advocate position that we're missing according to which, because this seems just like an egregious thing for this college president to say. We've told him this is unacceptable. And to my mind, it was more egregious after I read what he said. Horrible as you may find what he said, I was expecting worse, and one can imagine worse. And it wasn't said in the classroom. I mean, what would... is there somebody you respect who's making the case that she was dead on, and God bless her? Or
there's a lot of people who are making the case that for what's happened recently, where the protests and encampments have been shut down by the police, and the claim there is just it's been too disruptive to the university, and it's been breaking various university policies that they've turned a blind eye to, and they have a right to impose them, and they want to be able to have the normal workings again. That I understand. I'm sympathetic to it. Over this particular guy, I think that I'm, and to some extent you are, a minority view here. I think a lot of people would say free speech is all well and good, but there are other priorities that a university has. One thing which often gets brought up when somebody says something offensive, and this is the same with Amy Wax, who's an interesting case, who have said, I think she's now a self-defined, I heard on another on a podcast with Glenn Lowry, a race realist. And her race realism has not gone over well, and there's an investigation of her. And then what people always say is, but think of the students. You know, if it wasn't for the students, she could say all these things, but it sets up a bad environment for the students. How could a Black student take her class and feel comfortable? One might say this, here's the devil's advocate view. How could a Jewish student, or certainly an Israeli student, attend Mossad's classes and feel that they're getting a fair shake and being treated with the respect that they deserve?
Yeah. Now, Amy Wax went further. I mean, she talked about, as I recall, like numbers based on her own classes. She basically said, the Black kids in my class most of them are not qualified to be there, or something. It boiled down to that. She was very explicitly talking about her experience in her class. It would be pretty weird to be a Black student in her class after that. What you described couldn't lead to great discomfort as well, but it's different.
I mean, honestly, as a Jewish guy, and when I went to college, I would feel very strange walking into Mossad's class after reading that, and him celebrating in so many words, you know, a brutal attack on Jewish people. So, but I would say if you want to, before bring the burden of evidence when you. Bring up such a complaint about teaching is, how are his teaching evaluations? Are there complaints? How is his classroom behavior? Absent that, it's just a cheap excuse to get somebody for saying something that you find offensive.
Yeah. I mean, there are also differences between kind of law school and the whole undergraduate curriculum. And, you know, it's like, when you look at all the things that are covered in a liberal arts curriculum, you're going to get people who are writing about, you know, I also think at one point she was teaching a course that was kind of a prerequisite or something or mandatory. And I think they changed that and made her class strictly optional. Anyway, there is this separate issue of the protests. And I mean, first of all, I think we've got a little almost of the Streisand effect. They are said to be spreading across the country. And I think if Columbia hadn't initially called in the police to clear the area, you might have fewer of them. They don't seem to be all that big at most places where they are happening, but they're happening. And in any event, that's, you know, there's now a number of campuses where there's some degree of this. Now, let's start off with the, I mean, we both have been observing. Let me just do like a public service announcement first, okay? Bear in mind that when you're on social media and you, or you're just watching a highly ideological, fairly ideological news station, you are probably going to see the worst example in the whole country of anything that took place. And remember, there's a lot of, once there are a lot of these protests, and then there's a periphery which features students who are opposed and non-students who are opposed. And in fact, leave that aside. There's at Columbia, there's a whole city, you know, there's stuff happening out on Broadway. And I saw one example of something that got a lot of attention. You know, bear in mind, this is not representative of what's going on just statistically. Okay. Yeah. Everyone's got a smartphone. Everything is going to be covered. And through the magic of social media, whatever outrages you most will be delivered to you. You will see it. And so I would just...
I have to say something, which is, when you talk about concrete examples, but I saw the thing on Twitter where this guy triumphantly says, you know, there's, you know, this deeply anti-Semitic protests. So here's what my wife is bravely going to do. And you see her walking through campus and she's wearing a shirt that says Jew on it. And she's dressed in church. And she's walking through, she's filming it. It's very tense. And people are just looking at her and kind of smiling and everything. And absolutely nothing happens. First thing, a lot of the protesters are themselves Jewish. And he was waiting for something. So he puts on a video anyway and then achieves, I think, receives much deserved mockery. So sometimes there's a lot which is, there are definitely cases. But the idea that somebody, you know, who's Jewish will automatically be singled out for attacking is a horrible exaggeration. It's an exaggeration that plays into all sorts of, I think, unhealthy policies and unhealthy ideas. Anyway, just a digression.
And there is also, by the way, the issue of, like, not only will the most outrageous video make it your way, but in some cases, you may not see the video, but it will give rise to accounts that aren't even entirely representative of the video. Now, you sent me this Brett Stevens column. Brett is a nice guy. He's been on my podcast. Yeah. But he got a whole column out of this. And I think... It starts out with these two Jewish students reporting to him about how oppressive things are at Yale. And one of them says that a demonstrator jammed a Palestinian flag into her left eye. She ended up in the hospital, luckily without permanent injury. He quotes her saying, "Thank God there was a small sphere at the end of the pole." And then at the end of the column, he comes back to them like this. They are the framing of the column. I think you saw the same video I saw. What was the video? The video of this incident looked like what to you?
It looked like this guy's walking past with a flag and he accidentally hit her. I mean, he wasn't facing that. That's the impression I got.
I didn't think it was accidental, but it still wasn't this. What it was. So clearly this was a case where she and the guy, they'd been identified as like the opposition by the protesters. You know, there had been this whole thing. They're walking by and the flag, first of all, the end of the flag got nowhere near her eye. I'm sorry. Right. It was like it kind of, if you saw what I saw, the flag kind of, and it's not a, like a big super heavy pole, but it's like a stick and it kind of goes like that. Right. The stick with the end pointing out. Right. And I mean, you could almost describe it as a tap. I did think it was you couldn't say for sure. I did think it was intentional and technically assault and very bad, but what I kept seeing the phrase stabbed in the eye on social media, you know, and it wasn't that. But, you know, if you get a column out of it, that's efficient. We call efficient journalism.
You know, we've both seen the videos. In Columbia, some of the students were chanting, like, burn Tel Aviv to the ground. And outside the gates of Columbia, it got a little bit, you know, people screaming.
Was in Columbia, by the way. I think that was at a subway that looked like an overhead view of a subway stop where there were about 15 people chanting that.
You might be right.
Yeah.
But it had been some ugly incidents. Now, in any, if that's your standard in anything, you know, pro Trump, pro gay rights, whatever, there's going to be some ugly stuff, and it doesn't excuse it. But to use it as a way to say we have to shut down the whole thing, by those standards, just about every protest would be shut down.
Yeah, the I mean, one thing that was happening with that chant is something that. In another context, I found kind of creepy, and I'll describe it. But it was a case where there's one person who leads the chant. And then the people, there were at this thing, at that thing, maybe 12, 15 people, obligingly say whatever they said.
Yeah.
I mean, they could say, and your mother sleeps around, and yeah. Everybody would repeat it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a little, the case where that was, I thought, kind of creepy, but I'm not that indignant about it, I guess, was. So there were these anti-protesters who I guess were trying to encroach upon the space of the Columbia encampment. Did you see this where, and somebody said, you know, the Zionists are coming.
Yes.
And that was a little creepy. Although, look, Zionist is not an ethnic designation. It's an ideological designation still. And then the guy leading it, they form a line and say, we will not let them enter or something. Everybody says, we will not let them enter. And then he says, we will take a step forward to clear the space or something like that. And they take a step forward. I hate it when any group of people is unthinkingly repeating what one person says.
Yeah.
But that was like the creepiest thing I've seen. On the other hand, it would be a recipe for serious trouble if once you've got this encampment, you've got anti-protesters, which in the age of social media includes true provocateurs, inevitably on both sides, kind of walking through trying to get attention. Like, that could lead to really bad stuff. So I don't know. Have we solved everything?
I think we've resolved everything. Look, I mean, just 2 points. One thing is, I think we're in the same thing. I think there have been anti-Semitic incidents that they have been blown out of proportion, exaggerated. In some ways that are in themselves, I think, very harmful to Jewish people, Jewish students, who are then sort of being given the message that they hate Jews at Columbia. And yeah, I think that there are problems with this. In the age of social media, you're always going to find a clip. I also think, though, and I've heard reports from this, that it's an odd time to be walking around the campus wearing a yarmulke, being obviously Jewish. I think there is definitely hate crimes directed towards Jews at a higher rate than other groups. And it should be the cause of a lot of concern on campus. And then the second thing is, again, there's the hypocrisy, which is that I think administrators, and this is what the Republicans are on about, and they're kind of right, administrators are a lot more lenient about views that are expressions of views that are in some sense anti-Jewish than they would be at any other group. Mm-hmm. And you sent me this thing by John McWhorter talking about the parallels between this and the South African apartheid.
By the way, he's taking massive heat on Twitter for this column. I mean, from one side, from the pro-Palestine side, but inordinate heat. Anyway, go ahead.
So he talked about ways in which it's similar and which is different. But one way in which it's very different is that there were not, I assume, not that many white South Africans on campus at the time.
Right. And they weren't identifiable. Not that all Jews are, but some choose to be.
Yeah. And but the anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian side blurs into feelings about Jews, and there are a lot of Jews on campus. And so this is what makes this very different.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, as much as I wish some college president would have the courage to say to Elise Stefanik, and this Columbia president failed this test again, like the rest, have the courage to say, look, from the river to the sea, it means different things to different people. And I think to most of the students at my college chanting it, it doesn't mean kill all the Jews, okay?
Yeah.
And which is, you know, but of course Stefanik said, yes, I find it deeply offensive. And even, I think she even, I mean, this is her other pretty egregious. She's under a lot of pressure right now, I think, from a lot of faculty people and so on. She said that, yeah, that phrase might warrant discipline, you know, rather than actually create some clarity. Anyway, much as I want to say that, I also want to say it's understandable in the current political and geopolitical context that if you're Jewish and you hear that, it would feel very uncomfortable. Yeah. And you might think it means push the Jews into the sea. And to some people saying it, it means that. Certainly, you could find people somewhere in the Middle East and presumably America who mean that. But, you know, it's I take your point. This is a very dicey situation. And, you know, because and, you know, of course, there are also Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims and so on, who also have their own set of feelings that are by the same token, naturally sensitive in some cases. Yeah. So it's a mess. And
It is a mess. And the same hypocrisy issue comes up, though, which is, I think it's perfectly reasonable for you to point out from the river to the sea. And most people saying it absolutely is not a call for Jewish extermination. A lot of Jews say it, and they were involved in the protests. But on the other hand, for everything else, the university's policies typically are, you judge something not by the intent of the person saying it, but by the reactions of the people hearing it. So if it involved issues of gay people or trans people or Black people, there would be no means the sort of parsing that you and I are doing. If it's offensive to people, it should be shut down. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And so there's this double standard being realized. And what a lot of people do, I think, is a huge mistake, is saying, fine, let's include the Jews under the rubric of the gays and the Blacks and so on, and then punish people for saying these things. I would go the other way and say, we got to have more latitude for even offensive speech.
Right. In a way, this would be an opportunity for college president who wants to go the other way and
an
say—
an opportunity for courage.
Of a kind, and to do something probably a lot of them want to do anyway, which is make their, you know, campus speeches and so on less susceptible to what some people would call woke pressure, right?
Yeah.
In other words, want to just stick to a consistent, pretty free speech line. It would be a chance to say, you know, these protests should go on, and we should not discipline people for saying this, and we shouldn't discipline that professor and so on. But in light of this, we realize we've been a little too sensitive on other issues, and we're going to be more on the free speech side there. It would be a chance to say that. But maybe final thing I just want to say is, I guess I sent you this video, or did you? I think I sent you the Scott Galloway video.
Oh,
so
yes.
He's a professor at NYU, but also just kind of an intellectual celebrity with a podcast and this and that. And he's very, he's often provocative, but he's saying two things. He says, first of all, and he's on Morning Joe and getting full affirmation from this morning. It wasn't Joe himself, but I think it's Morning Joe kind of stand-in guy, I think. He says, look, if I put on a white hood and said lynch the Blacks or burn the gays, he's making a comparison to what's happening at NYU. And I thought, you know, that's funny. Even though social media will pick up the most inflammatory thing said, I actually haven't heard anything comparable to that, right? Like kill the Jews. I have not heard that. And he's making a pretty ridiculous comparison, I think. But there it is. He's the intellectual celebrity. And then he also says, I think we're being manipulated by TikTok. But that's actually more common. There was a I wrote a piece in the Non-Zero newsletter. I think it was actually called Special Cold War Freakout Issue or something, but it got into the TikTok thing. And the Wall Street Journal had this piece reporting that actually the movement to kind of ban TikTok was kind of dead in the water, or it was like didn't have any momentum. And October 7 did breathe life into it because there is so much pro-Palestine stuff on TikTok. Now, I would think that the demographics of TikTok help explain that.
Yeah.
But anyway, Scott Galloway says it's the CCP.
So, yeah. So I don't know Scott Galloway at all, but I listened to his podcast with Kara Swisher at Pivot. It's very good. It's a good tech podcast. So regarding the second point, I got to say, I find there's sort of a lack of imagination and takes back and forth about this. So when you send me the video and at the end he blamed China, it's original. I never thought that the Chinese connection is just, I don't know if it's true or not. It doesn't seem very plausible. I think there's a simpler explanation for why TikTok leans more heavily towards the anti-Israel side. But, you know, I don't know. I think of, and you're right, the White Hood stuff is a really unfair analogy. Here's a better analogy. I think probably a good parallel to From the River to the Sea is All Lives Matter.
Which, somebody brought that up, and that was actually an interesting point. Was that McWhorter? Who brought that up?
I don't know. I was, thought it was me.
Was it you?
I was just thinking right now. I didn't. This is my fresh idea. If somebody brought it up, they're just plagiarizing for me.
As a psychologist, you know that we're all inclined to take more credit for things than we're actually due.
As a psychologist, I know we all believe we're the exception to these things, but only I'm right. Anyway, the All Lives Matter parallel is a lot of people saying All Lives Matter simply, you know, mean All Lives Matter. What's the problem? And they say that we should care about, you know, about the lives of people besides Black people, certainly including Black people. Other people take it as a fundamentally racist thing, as a disrespect to say that these people, these that Blacks have suffered a special burden and so on. So now here's a more fair analogy. There's a bunch of protesters at Columbia with All Lives Matter signs chanting that they, support the police, chanting against affirmative action. I guess I just think that they would have a really rough time of it. I think a much rougher time than, and again, the response isn't no, you know, the response isn't that we should treat, I'm tying myself in knots here. The response is that the same deference that we should give to the free speech for the anti-Israeli people, we should give for the All Lives Matter people.
Yeah. I would say almost at least as much. From the River to Sea seems to me more plausibly, more plausibly offensive, I was going to say. It has
maybe,
more of a history.
Maybe
the phrase
it
All Lives Matter does not have a whole history of people meaning different things. Now, I will say the very first use of From the River to the Sea apparently is in the Likud charter, the Likud party, the Benjamin Netanyahu's part of. That charter has been superseded by another charter, but it was basically, this is going to be all a state in which Jews, in some sense, have a privileged status. And, and most Palestinians, well, a lot of people saying this would say, they wouldn't. It is an implication of what they're saying that ultimately, if, you know, you would wind up with at least the reverse, probably. But if you play out like, you know, if they just said, we're just saying everyone should get to vote. Yeah, okay. Makes sense to me. I'm not against that, but you can see how some Jews would and Israelis in particular might follow that, the implications of that, and realize ultimately that could be trouble.
So Galloway's analogy is too harsh. Mine might be too mild. Maybe I won't take credit for it after all. I gotta say, by the way, I've been going like really strong pro-free speech is what I tend to believe. If I had a colleague who said the things that Mossad said, I find it very disturbing. And there is a part of me that would want somebody to give him a talking to. I just don't think that part of me should be listened to. But I understand the impulse.
Well, and even that part of you probably wouldn't say his university should tell him it's unacceptable, which I take to mean you're going to be fired if you do it again, right?
Yeah, and we both, I sent you something by this guy on Twitter who's making a lot of noise about this, and he just repeatedly says, you got to do something about these professors, these pro-Hamas professors. And what is it to be done about them? You're going to fire them? You're going to fire the tenured ones too? You're going to cut their salary? You're going to, you know, and I don't think there's anything that can be done. If people break laws, that's a different story. Mm-hmm. If people are derelict in their responsibility to train students, that's a different story. What they say is it should be protected.
Yeah.
Okay. No.
I think we got it straightened
out. I think we settled it.
Okay.
Rationality mixed with cognitive empathy. It just resolves everything.
Isn't it? Aren't we amazing? I don't know. So Daniel Dennett.
Daniel Dennett.
Yeah. What would you say about Daniel Dennett?
So I knew Dan. I think just a lot of people in my field have. I knew him enough to, you know, have dinner with him, have drinks with him, met in conferences. I commented on his work. He commented on my work. And I think he was an astonishing intellect. He was a model philosopher in many ways, very, very integrated with cognitive science, psychology, neuroscience, AI, robotics. I don't know anything about how he died. I think he was 83.
82 or 83, yeah.
But I know
I think he had a heart attack years ago.
Yeah. But I know up until now, I heard him on a podcast with Jordan Peterson. I was curious what his last podcast was like. And he sounded very lucid and sharp. I have thoughts about Peterson's contribution, but he sounded on the ball. And he also wrote a really good article for The Atlantic on what he called counterfeit people, where he raised an alarm bell about AIs acting like people and was very harshly critical of it. He was just involved in everything. Very, very strong proponent idea, not only in his own research and his own thoughts, but in general, philosophy should integrate more of cognitive science. His theories about consciousness and free will and metaphysics were very informed. I disagreed with him over a lot of things, but I think this is an amazing mind and also a beautiful writer. Mm-hmm. So what's your take?
First of all, I'm curious, was he saying that AI, he's worried about AI playing its almost naturally anthropomorphic role? Or
He's particularly worried about corporations or bad actors using AI to mimic people online in other ways with an intent to defraud, to manipulate elections, to mess with people.
Okay,
He argued, kind of, I'm not sure this isn't verbatim, but people who are involved in this should suffer severe penalties. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking he might have said something lined up against a wall and shot, but not quite that bad, but very severe.
Yeah. I knew him. I debated him at Harvard once when my book Non-Zero came out. And I think he was part of the New Atheist team that I was part of a team debating in Mexico when I was there. I know I saw him there and talked to him.
Dad Day's ideas.
That's right. See you, Dad Day.
As my wife calls it, Ted Mex.
It's a cool event, kind of.
It's a very cool event.
You're treated like a celebrity. So, yeah. And I will say, this leads to one relatively favorable thing I'd say about him, at least compared to the other people he's in this context. So Chris Hitchens was at this thing. Sam Harris was at this thing. I was debating, like, you know, part of a debate against all of them. The four designated new atheists were those three and Richard Dawkins, designated by Wired magazine, which put them on the cover and called them the new atheists.
The four horsemen, right?
The four, yeah, they were sometimes called the four horsemen of the apocalypse or something. Of the four, Dan was the least pernicious. And I considered them pernicious because I think the view that religion, I'm not against atheism, but the view, it was beyond that. There was an ideology, and it was that religion is the source of our troubles. Richard Dawkins, an extremely naive statement, said, if it weren't for religion, there would be no Israel-Palestine conflict. It's like, dude, it's a conflict over land between two people who don't speak the same language. That can really readily happen without, and in fact, by the way, the original Zionists were not religious at all. They were extremely secular. It wasn't a religious crusade. And the original Palestinian resistance was not particularly Islamic. There were a lot of Palestinian Christians and so on. I personally thought this was the kind of ideology that just drives, you know, the foreign policy we were seeing at the time, which was George Bush's foreign policy. And I don't think Dan Dennett really bought into that. Maybe I'm missing something, but I thought the things he said about the war on terror that I heard were mostly reasonable things. Whereas Sam, you know, Sam Harris was like, there's some really creepy things. He says, like, we're going to have to see some real blood and we're going to blah, blah, blah. It was like, it was gross. And I think history showed that it wasn't wise. But so that was, I thought he was very reasonable in that one. He was very kind of reasonable generally. Well, there's an example I have that touches on me that I'll get to in greater detail later, where I don't think he was being reasonable, but happens to all of us. The other thing I'd say is he brought a lot of people, he got a lot of people interested in a lot of intellectual issues,
yeah,
and engaged their minds and helped them think about them. His writing was, you know, it was very good at carrying people along kind of slowly at a reasonable pace for a layperson through arguments, counterarguments, and so on. I mean, would you say, I'm not enough of a philosopher to talk about his big achievements in philosophy. Would you say he was more of a, you know, more of a popularizer than a, I mean, he advocated positions for sure. He wasn't, yeah, a popularizer in the sense of, you know, in the minimal sense of it. But what, I don't know, did he make, are there contributions he's known for among philosophers?
Yeah, I think there are people who are just pure popularizers, and there's people who nicely straddle both theories, who are well-respected in their fields and popularizers. And Dennett is definitely one of them. Similar in some way to Dawkins, at least during most of his career, where Dawkins was taken very seriously in the field, but also become much of a popularizer. So Dennett was well known for his work on consciousness, his series of consciousness, his work on free will. I think that those are on intelligence and cognition in general, played a role in the nativism, debates over nativism and the debates, certainly a very strong adaptationist. And arguing for the very powerful natural selection creating our minds. And so, and these views he expels in popular works, but they're taken very, very seriously. You read current work in philosophy of mind or consciousness and so on, and Dennett is referred to, you know, with a lot of seriousness. So, yeah. And he had longstanding debates with philosophers. Certainly the one I found most entertaining because I was a graduate student at MIT is with Jerry Fodor, who was also a brilliant philosopher and a very strong debater, and they would often debate issues. With David Chalmers, who's currently at NYU, there was a longstanding debate about consciousness, about zombies. Mm-hmm. And he's very, very taken very seriously in the field.
Yeah, it's funny in the, on consciousness, I'm actually, well, I'll read this thing that raises a question of how much there is that's new here, but I think his book Consciousness Explained came at a time when there was a lot of like neuroscience stuff coming out and people were starting to take seriously, like maybe, I mean, lay people largely, that maybe consciousness can be precisely mapped up onto brain states.
Yeah.
It's all just generated by the brain or however you want to put it. His book was kind of arguing that in some sense takes the mystery out of it. We can explain it. And I just think that is like really, really wrong. And I think that came to be more the view. In other words, people realize, well, okay, there's this one-to-one correspondence between subjective experience and what's going on in the brain, but it's still subjective experience. And there's all these reasons why, it's not clear why that would evolve, why that would be part of evolution. And B, it's not clear like how it would happen. The so-called water into wine problem, as I think Colin McGann called it. But anyway, in the second to last email I got from where he was excoriating me for something he heard I had said about his views, which I hadn't said, as I explained. And so his follow-up email was much more cordial. But the last thing he says, he's saying, there's this dispute we had. He said, I haven't quoted you on that. The only thing I quote you on, and this is the last line in the email, is he quotes a line from, it's the end notes in my book, Non-Zero. He says, the only thing I keep quoting to people is your line, because this line drove him crazy, okay? And the line is from me in the end notes to my book. It is, quote, "Of course, the problem here is with the claim that consciousness is, in quotes, identical to physical brain states. The more Dennett et al. Try to explain to me what they mean by this, the more convinced I become that what they really mean is that consciousness doesn't exist." He really didn't want to be seen. I still don't see how he's not, how it doesn't boil down to that. And I guess I can quickly tell you why. But the background is, you know, his mentor was Gilbert Ryle, who I think did explicit, I think he explicitly said consciousness doesn't exist, right?
You're putting your finger on an issue with Dennett, which is a lot of people have your interpretation of him, that deep down he's saying that consciousness doesn't exist, or that qualia, qualitative phenomenological experience, like the feeling of having your car slammed in a, your hand slammed in the car door, or eating a hot pepper. There's no such thing as that. And at times he seemed to be saying that, and at other times he would deny it. I think if I had to sum up, and I want to get back to the consciousness thing in particular, but I think if you had to sum up Dennett's view, and I'm trying to think what ties together everything besides the sort of attitude towards science I'm talking about, is that he hated the idea of magic. And magic, mysterious. He hated the idea of magic. Mysterious forces, that sort of thing. So he had a very mechanistic view of decision-making that precluded ideas about free will. He doesn't think that consciousness is this sort of weird substance floating around or this mysterious thing, or even that it somehow is produced magically by brain states. He tried to adopt sort of computational, evolutionary, neurological views of these things.
Yeah.
Careful to draw connections between machines and animals, and sort of naturalize philosophy, make it more natural. Mm-hmm. Connected to the scientific program. With regard to consciousness, I mean, here's one way I think to capture Dennett's view, and I hope I get it right. People will tell me if I get it wrong. But people like to talk about the idea of a philosophical zombie. And the idea of a philosophical zombie is I'm talking to you, and you're talking back to me, and you're behaving properly, and maybe you're doing planning and have a memory and so on. But the challenge is, what do you need consciousness for all of that? And you could imagine a creature that's just like a person, every possible way, except without consciousness. Yeah. And put that way, is consciousness a real mystery? Why do we need this magical thing? Yeah. Dennett rejected that. Dennett said there's no such thing as that. As a result of having memory, competence in human action, language skills and everything, consciousness just is or emerges from that. An idea of a philosophical zombie is incoherent. And that's how we differ, for instance, from David Chalmers, who very much believes in the zombie point.
Yeah, by the way, I made the zombie argument in my 1988 book, Three Scientists and Their Gods, and David Chalmers read that as a graduate student. So maybe I had some influence there. But I laid it out exactly like that. I didn't use the word zombie, but I said imagine, you know, a species on another planet. Imagine even natural selection taking place on another planet is like, so, okay, self-replicating material, blah, 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 behavior gets more complex. Why at some point would you expect it to start, you know, being like something to be an organism? Why would subjective experience suddenly pop in? Was it built in from the beginning? I called it superfluous. I think Chalmers used the term the extraness of consciousness. But I see, on Dennett, I agree with all the computational view that you're saying he takes. I'm the same way, at least as much, and I always have been. But see, I think that heightens the question of the mystery of consciousness, partly for reasons we've just described. It's like, you know, if you are a true materialist, if you believe that when I put my hand in the fire, I withdraw. You can explain why I reflexively withdraw my hand in strictly physical terms. Then what is the subjective experience of pain doing causally? If indeed you can describe it in terms of physical information flow up and down my arm and so on, which I think you can. And so that's the question. And last thing I'll say before,
if it was a channel Dennett here, I would say for a reflex motion, you don't need a notion of pain. It could just be the system. But
for the sort of uses that pain does in your everyday life, where, you know, mm-hmm. you're kind of scared to go near the stove because you got burnt there before. You recognize the pain of the stove is similar to you stubbing your toe. You, when your kid gets hurt, you feel sympathy. When you list everything, all of the things, your behaviors and thoughts having to do with pain, there's going to be nothing left over that you'd call consciousness. The sum of all that is the idea that pain hurts.
I think I missed that. I was I went on a tangent based on the first five words you uttered. Say that again.
This is the power of my argument. I think Dennett would argue that when you take a list of all the things pain does for us, mm-hmm. behaviorally, psychologically, from the standpoint of perception, you put them all together in a list. Mm-hmm. You don't need anything else. It's hurtingness just is all of those things put together, or what underlies all of those things.
No, but my point is you don't need the things themselves. You don't even need the elements you just listed. You don't need the subjective experience to explain the behavior. Now, you do need it to explain why we're talking about consciousness. And that is an interesting fact, that once you have language in a species, consciousness has a causal influence. But the fact is, we all believe it preceded that, right? I think monkeys feel pain. And the question is, why would that be the case? And because the default behavioral science view, actually, it's largely implicit, but it is that we can explain everything in terms of physical information flow.
And that, by the way, is a commonality between your picture and Dennett's. So Dennett was unsympathetic to people like John Searle, who thought brains somehow, it's a matter of having a brain. He said any computational system of sufficient complexity will be conscious.
Sure. Last thing I'll say before we go into overtime is, to me, the problem is with the claim that consciousness is identical to physical brain states, which I think was his claim, is that for two things to be identical, they have to share all their properties. Would you agree? That's what
Leibniz's law. Yeah.
So physical brain states have a consciousness, have a property that subjective experience doesn't. My physical brain states can be viewed by people other than me. My subjective experiences cannot be. That's what we mean by a subjective experience. To me, this is not very complicated. The reason you can't say they're identical. What the fuck does that mean other than you're actually saying consciousness doesn't exist? I literally don't understand it. Now, look, smart people say it. Well, who's the guy? I had a long podcast conversation with this who he's one of the leading proponents of it probably now. But anyway, this was years ago. But so there's smart people who say it. I don't know what it means, but because you cannot convince me that subjective experience and physical brain states have all of their properties in common.
Could I duck that point and throw an analogy at you and get your sense of it?
I will take ducking as surrender, but yes.
You're going to bring this back later on, the kind I gave up on your superior arguments, just like for the simulation theory argument you threw at me. We ask, somebody says, well, what is love? What is the love that a parent has towards their child? And you, a good evolutionary psychologist, say, well, you know, kin selection, reproduction, natural selection guides parents, and particularly species like ours, to devote care and affection and concern for their offspring, because otherwise the genes wouldn't blah, 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 blah. This is expressed in hormones and so on, standard story. And then somebody says, but Bob, are you denying that love is real?
No.
And no, you'd say
no. It is. I'm not saying subjective experience is nothing more than the brain state, which he is. I'm saying it's this bizarre and special thing that gives life meaning. And it's the reason, once we start talking about it, we construct moral systems and think that the welfare of human beings matters. It has a lot of important consequences, which actually feeds into the thing we will talk about in overtime. But no. Love exists. That's what we have not explained. Why does the subjective experience of love exist? You can show me all the brain states you want, and that doesn't explain it.
So where would you go from there? Like, what kind of theory do you need that would explain? So you say, look, this brain state is gives rise to consciousness, identical to consciousness, sorry, gives rise to consciousness, but is not the same as it. So now you need a sort of an explanation for how a brain state can give rise to this other thing.
Well,
and there are theories, and I'm curious what you think.
Well, there's two questions. How? The water into wine question? Who knows? I don't know. It's hard to even think about. We may never... The beings experiencing subjective experience may be in principle incapable of really understanding how it comes about. That may be like, you know, some sort of rough equivalent of an incompleteness theorem or something. But the but as for why, if there is an answer to the why question, it has to be cosmic in one sense or another, I think. And
cosmic?
Cosmic.
I guess, like, higher being cosmic?
Well, it wouldn't have to be a being. I mean, this gets into the what we'll talk about. And I should say, although we're about to go into overtime, and that's accessible to people who are paid subscribers to either my newsletter, Non-Zero, or your Falsely Modest newspaper, Small Potatoes. There's a conversation I had with Dennett that is online. If you go to YouTube, Google our names. This is like 25 years ago. I'm like arguably more attractive.
I watched the video just
than I am now. It's like another being. He actually held up pretty well. I seem to have aged more than he has, but it's the one that's an hour long. People have like cut this up into clips and so on. It's the one that's around an hour long, the whole thing. And about 10 minutes into it or something, we start talking about whether there could be a larger purpose. Not necessarily that whether the unfolding of evolution could serve a larger purpose, which I think is a real possibility, even though I'm just talking about nuts and bolts material, the material process of natural selection, no spooky forces. And I'm not saying a God necessarily set it up. We could be in a simulation. Extraterrestrials could have planted the initial seed of life with some idea of what they're trying to get. Or, interestingly, and by the way, I heard Joe Rogan allude to this theory the other day. For a while, I was one of the very few people talking about it. There's a natural selection kind of explanation that involves the replication of universes that could account for evolution having some purpose. Anyway, if it does, let me submit that there is only one. The idea that consciousness is epiphenomenal, right? That it has a relationship to your brain that a shadow of your hand has to your hand. In other words, it is influenced by your brain, but doesn't influence your brain. It's not dualism. It's not Cartesian dualism. The idea that it's just this byproduct that doesn't do anything, you might think it's impossible to have a functional explanation of that by definition if it doesn't do anything. But as we've said, once you have language, it does do something. It changes the conversation. It changes what people do and how they treat each other. The only way to explain that as functional is to see there being purpose at the level of the whole evolutionary system. Again, whether God, alien, simulation, natural selection among universes, whatever imparted the purpose, you can imagine even an epiphenomenal consciousness having a purpose. That's not the theory Rogan alluded to. That's, I think I'm the only person, I'm not aware of anyone who said this before me. And if you want to see my written version of it, go to the New York Times thing where I say, does evolution have a higher purpose? It's a New York Times piece by me. And then click on a link that goes to meaningoflife.tv. And I actually wrote up a thing. But that...
Maybe just a quibble, but I understand the idea of evolution having a purpose if some higher being, a god, an alien, whatever, set it up. The idea of it, of its purpose emerging from natural selections among universes, seems to just push the question back. Why have we set up a system of natural selection among universes that itself gave rise to a creature of a purpose?
Yeah, it's so funny you say that, because you could have said the same thing to Darwin. You could have said, oh, look, it's kind of an interesting theory, I guess, but what created natural selection, Mr. Darwin? What you're asking me is exactly like that. And the reason you ask it, and so many people do, is they think I'm positing like I'm being a Christian or something, and I have a religious answer that I'm pushing, and I want to say, I have found the ultimate cause. It is a God that existed before time and so on. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it may be that there are some interesting features of natural selection that can be explained by the possibility of having purpose. Just as Darwin said, there are interesting features of animals that can be explained by them being products of natural selection. So, yeah, you push it one level back, and that's also called expanding our understanding of things. We know more than we did. I mean, if this turned out to be true.
So this is, I've heard you make this argument before, but I thought in a subtly different way. I thought you would take moral progress as a sign of an underlying purpose. But here, that argument is compatible. Would argue that consciousness, or is it, did it have you right before?
We've actually had this conversation while walking along the sidewalk in New Haven.
I remember that.
The answer is the moral stuff. I think if you want to argue, we there's moral progress associated with human history. That becomes interesting once you get to the if you get to the point where you're saying, well, maybe there is a purpose. The whole thing. Wonder what the purpose is. Like, could there be a God behind it, blah, blah, blah. Then the moral stuff, I think, becomes more relevant. But no, the argument that there's at least some evidence of purpose, and this was the source of the big dispute between me and Dennett, which I'll get into later. It's a structural argument. I'm just saying, like, you know, as the planet has developed, if you step back and view the whole evolutionary process, in some ways it looks like an animal unfolding, maturing, embryogenesis. Wow. We're seeing a global brain being built even as we speak. I'm saying that kind of thing is relevant. People, when they first hear that, almost invariably misunderstand the argument and say, but wait, no, we understand why all this stuff is happening, because like natural selection created humans, humans are smart, they build this technology. No, I get that. I get that. That is like objecting to Darwin's theory of natural selection by saying, but no, we understand why organisms unfold. See, there's these stem cells, and then they do this and they do that. And Darwin's saying, well, we're right. But why is it that once you've seen the whole thing, it looks like there was some interesting algorithm at its seed, you know, at the beginning, which we now know is DNA.
So does this capture the sort of structure of your argument, which I see, which is the Darwinian story is natural selection just works because of certain brute facts, that there's random variation, there's differential reproduction upon selection, and so on. Those are just brute facts of the world. And that's how we get complicated animals and so on. And you're stepping back and saying, but doesn't it need explanation that these simple, dumb processes
strictly speaking, I wouldn't say that's what needs an explanation. I would say the more the whole thing seems to unfold over 3 billion years into something that looks like an organism. I mean, people are now seriously talking about a global level of consciousness that isn't even instantiated in humans. It may be AIs, right? And I'm saying, when you see that kind of pattern, and this is the interesting thing, is that Dennett, you know, we need to go into overtime. But I will say that on that video, the 1 hour video, I have this discussion with him, and it starts about 10 minutes in, and he seems to concede after about 10 minutes that yes, what I say, this thing you see in organisms, which is directional movement toward functionality at higher levels of organization, you see that, you know, and as an organism goes from one cell to blah, blah, blah. I say to the extent that we can say that's true of natural selection is that at least some evidence, however tiny, at least some evidence of purpose or of design purpose. We both saw design and purpose as the same thing. We both agreed that you can talk about natural selection designing organisms, yeah, instilling the purpose of genetic replication and so on. He seems to finally concede that yes. And I wrote that up in a way that was too sensationalistic, but it drove him nuts. I'll talk about this in overtime. Big argument between us that was never really, I would say we were never after that on great terms. We talked cordially sometimes, but and I'll talk about that. And perhaps other things. But we've been, do you realize how much content, as they say, we've given away for free, Paul?
We keep saying we're going to switch to the paid kind.
I know. You keep asking. Yeah, you got me. Somebody got me on my hobby horse. I think
there should be some way of billing the free subscribers for this.
We should have it should start out cheap. It should be like a pay meter it grows. The per minute rate grows. And they're like the frogs in the boiling water. Idea. They're like the they don't know what hit them, and they look at the bill afterwards and go, okay.
Also, we might discuss the three body problem.
Oh yeah, I do. If I still have enough energy left for either of these things. So again, you can go to either of our newsletters, become a paid subscriber. There will be a post at the newsletter that will contain the overtime, and I think let you subscribe to a podcast feed that will include all such overtimes. Okay, so anything else, Paul?
No, it's I'm waiting for the paywall section just as badly as our listeners are.
Well, thanks to everybody, including those who are going to follow us into overtime, which is where we are going now.